everybody. I'm Kate.
And I'm Heather.
And we're making life.
Today, our guest is Jules Piperl, a non-binary New York City-based costumer for Broadway and off-Broadway theater, as well as film and TV. They've worked on Mean Girls, To Kill a Mockingbird, and Carousel on Broadway, at New York Theater Workshop and National Queer Theater off-Broadway, and John Oliver, among many others.
Yay, Jules! Thank you for coming!
Thank you so much for having me.
Yay! So we know each other through singing, and you and Heather are meeting right now. And I have learned more about this part of your life since you agreed to come on the podcast than I ever knew before. But there's still a whole lot that I don't know, and we're really excited to learn a whole bunch of different things. But how did you decide to become a full-time costumer? Was there a particular moment that started that for you? Was there like an epiphany or a deciding experience?
That's a great question. I've always been really interested in theater. I've always been a very artistic person, and I participated in a lot of different art things throughout, you know, grade school and high school. And then in college, I acted in some theater, and then I was like, this isn't really the thing. And then somebody had asked me to design a show that I was in, which don't ever do a production role and an acting role and show at the same time. Terrible.
Oh my God.
But I did really enjoy it. And so I started thinking more seriously about costume design, and I got to do, because I didn't go to theater school, I went to a liberal arts school. I got to costume design pretty much everything because I was the only person there who was interested in costume design, which was a blessing because it meant that I had designed like 20 shows before I graduated college. So I had all that experience with that, and I decided that I really wanted to go into theater professionally. But the thing that is really useful about theater production positions is that for a lot of them, there's kind of a whole world of like fractal positions in it. So I knew I wanted to go into theater. And I was like, you know, if I just end up doing wardrobe forever, like at least I'm doing theater. If I get to do the creative side, that would be amazing. So I managed to get a job doing wardrobe in New York. And so I got to move to New York because I was like, well, I'm employed for the next 2 months doing wardrobe on this off-Broadway show. And so I'm going to just go and, you know, figure it out. And so I did. And so that was, you know, working full time doing theater, but not doing the creative side of theater. And then so I started gradually transferring into doing more and more creative work and less wardrobe work until I was doing entirely design and working in shops and building things on commission and stuff like that, which is like a huge blessing.
So for those of us who don't know, like me, what is the difference between wardrobe and costuming, and is it often a transition that people make from wardrobe to costuming?
Yeah, that's a great question, because especially in the film industry, wardrobe just refers to like the entire department of costumes. In the theater industry, it's costuming is making all of the clothes, providing all of the clothes, and wardrobe is taking care of the clothes during the show. Doing costume changes is wardrobe, making sure the actors are okay is wardrobe, doing all the clothes is wardrobe. And it is a very different job, but it's a very good way to get into the industry if you have no familiarity with it. So I'm very grateful that I got to do it when I was fresh out of college and 20 years old and had no idea what I was doing. And I just showed up and like did what the stage manager told me to do. I was very lucky to have a stage manager who was like, you are extremely green and I will show you the ropes.
Thank you for listening to your stage manager. We love when people do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I love stage managers.
We love you back.
And wardrobe is really exciting. It means that you can be close to the action. You know, there's something about being part of live theater that, like, there's nothing like it. But I started shifting my focus towards the making of the costumes, the purchasing of the costumes, the designing of the costumes, as opposed to the being there to take care of the clothes, because it is quite a different job. But if you have no experience, it's much easier to get into the wardrobe side of things, and then through the people that you meet there, get other jobs doing other things in the costume.
So this isn't in the questions we sent you. but it just made me think, ready, set, real-time conversation versions of interviews. Your first job out of college was an off-Broadway show. Am I understanding that fully?
Technically, my first job out of college was designing a summer stock.
Cool.
And then I went home and was very depressed for several months. Oh. And then I got a job. I mean, it's the classic tale, right? And then I got a job doing an off-Broadway show.
Right. So
the Bad Ones, that is very dear to my heart. It's like Kerrigan and Loudon Milk musical. If you ever heard the song Runaway With Me, it's from that show.
Oh, cool.
It's a lovely show. I very much enjoyed working on it.
Awesome. So my question, as a native New Yorker who moved somewhere else to do theater professionally, is, and I'm just having this right now, so maybe it won't be the best phrased thing in the world, but like, when I was starting out in theater, the narrative was, and I think still primarily is, that if you want to do this for a living, there are two places you go. You either go to LA or you go to New York, and that's how you make a living out of doing the thing. In your lived experience, how important was living in New York to you and your idea of what being a successful costumer was going to look like?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not familiar with the theater world outside of New York, so I don't think I can speak to other people's experiences doing theater outside of New York. I know that like regional theater is a thriving and really exciting business and place to work. For me, I did really want to go to New York because I wanted to be close to Broadway, and then Broadway also kind of feeds just like this whole industry of like the access that you have as a creative to materials. The New York City Garment District is an incredible resource, and other people and other theater companies is really, really useful. So I wouldn't say that like my understanding of being a successful costumer was based on being in New York, but I will say that like I enjoy being in New York, and feeling like I'm kind of at the heart of American theater.
Where are you from?
I am from Maryland. I was born in the UK, and I also have lived in parts of Europe, but I am from, I went to high school in Maryland, and then I went to college in New Jersey, and then I went back to Maryland, and then I moved to New York.
Okay, what prompted the decision to move? Because you did go home first.
Well, I think as it was for many people, the going home was not like the dream. I was totally panicked about not having a job out of college, and then I did get a job out of college, and I was thrilled about it, and I had a really good time making this summer stock happen. And then the summer stock was over, and I just was like, okay, and I went back home, and it was horrible.
Fair enough.
So yeah, that was not the goal. That was not the dream. We did not go to a great mental place after that happened. And then I think I had a friend tell me, like, you need to get out. Like, I was on the phone with a very dear friend, and they were like, you need to leave. Like, this isn't going to work for you. And I was like, oh, God, you're right. And so then I started looking for, like, any way to get a job and get out. And I actually, this is kind of a fun story, if you don't mind me going into, like, story mode.
Please.
I took a job through someone that I had worked with in college, their professional director that I worked with in college. I took this like minuscule wardrobe job working on a one weekend dance piece in New York, and, you know, helped actors into like crazy dance costumes, and was only there for the weekend. But while I was there for the weekend, and I had actually brought my girlfriend at the time, so I was like, we'll go to New York, it'll be fun. I ran into in Central Park somebody that I had worked with when we were both students in college. And it was a complete happenstance. Yeah. And we just like said hello. And then it turned out that he was working as like a assistant producer for a small New York theater company. And they were looking for a wardrobe person for this show that they were doing. And I was like, oh my God, oh my God, please, please. Get me. And so I sent him my resume like immediately. And then I got a interview, which I was only able to take because another friend of mine needed my help at Comic Con because she was doing the cosplay contest at New York Comic Con.
Oh,
and
cool.
So she like shared her hotel room with me so that I could help her out at New York Comic Con.
Awesome.
And because I was in town for that, I was able to do this interview. And then I got the job and then I got to do Wardo. So that was like the thing that let me move to New York. And it was really like a hilarious combination of factors for which I am deeply grateful.
That is so much serendipity that it feels like fate.
Yes.
Yeah. What a beautiful thing. So as I think I've told you, when I started doing stage managing professionally, it was a whole, I mean, like I had 10 years of community theater stage management under my belt. And so I was prepared in some ways. And there were some parts of the job that I had never done before, because in community theater, particularly when you're doing Shakespeare in the Park, woo, Shakespeare in the Park.
Yeah.
You don't have to call cues for lighting and sound. You don't have to do a run sheet. You don't, you know, like there's a whole bunch of stuff that I learned on the job, and I'm deeply grateful to my my boss and everybody there who helped me sort that out in real time and was patient with me. But what's something about being a professional costumer that surprised you when you were starting out?
The way that I did costuming in college was actually surprisingly similar to the way that it is done professionally. And for that, I am forever grateful to the costume shop at the Princeton University Lewis Center for the Arts, because they are incredible. They're all fabulous, fabulous professionals and really, really good at their job. And were very patient with me. And I think through them, I learned a lot of just like how the job works. But that being said, when I started doing theater internships throughout college, I was very surprised by some things, especially I think the degree to which the costume department is kind of responsible for like taking care of the actors.
Hmm.
Like I remember I was interning at the Signature Theater and I had to like buy shampoo for actors.
No.
And I was like, we're buying shampoo? Why? Can't they bring their own shampoo? And gradually over the course, I think this is also something that I learned from wardrobe. So another reason that I'm grateful that I've done wardrobe work. Actors have a lot going on. A lot of times no one is looking out for them. And often it is the costume department that like really is closest to the actors and like looking out for their needs in terms of comfort, in terms of things that they need, like, you know, if they need toiletries or like extra makeup or like things to take care of them, very much being responsible for that. And I'm really glad that I picked up that quality. It definitely wasn't my responsibility in college. And I'm glad that I picked it up in the professional world, because it means that especially when I'm working on like smaller shows where everyone is stressed and no one is really looking out for the actors, that I'm the one to be like, hey, this person has been buried in a set piece up to her neck for 2 hours. Can we give her a break now, please?
Mm-hmm.
And just being that person, which also, you know, it makes actors like me. And then that makes them easier to work with. And like, it's just a thing that I wasn't expecting, that like somebody has to pay attention to the comfort of these people because they are being very accommodating. And costumes, among other departments, but costume is often the one that takes that responsibility. So
that's really interesting, because that's such a cardinal part of my training as a stage manager. That
you take absolutely. Care of
your actors, you make sure that they have not just, you know, snacks, but also, you know, pack some deodorant for them if they don't have it, bring some safety pins, like make sure they've got their crap. And then when I was stage managing dance, it was a totally different experience, because it was completely hands-off with the dancers. Mm-hmm. I could say hello to them, and I gave them their calls, and I brought the things that I always bring, and I was able to offer some of those things to them when they needed it, which was really nice, but it wasn't part of what was expected of me.
Mm-hmm.
In that particular job. And I was so used to doing that
mm-hmm.
all the time.
Maybe it depends on the show. Like,
yeah, on the show and on the
costume designer mm-hmm. and wardrobe person or the stage manager who's doing that.
Well, yeah, and it also depends on the company, because like Signature right. Theater is, you know, they have like shower facilities and like provide, you know, things for the actors in a way that smaller companies that I've worked with have not. You know, sometimes it depends. But it's definitely something that for me is a cardinal part of the job, is to make sure that these people are like getting the support that they need.
That's really beautiful. And I appreciate, as somebody who comes at it from the stage management space that like that's part of your learning about how to do this and that you bring that into every project you do because it makes everybody's life easier.
Absolutely. Yeah. I did a show once where I was doing wardrobe for it and the show very much felt like a film. It was about people working in DC in the 80s, like politicians. And so everybody had a lot of costumes. They had a lot of like suits and, you know, different striped shirts that need to be, you know, changed out and different ties and whatever. And all of the actors were so stressed. So stressed with like all of their really difficult subject matter and all of the different scenes and the sort of switching back and forth through time. And so their costume changes that they were meant to be tracking were just too much for anybody to expect them to track. And so I just made sure it was me and then like a couple of other people that I was sort of managing, had everything just like laid out for them when they came in. Because there's just no way that anybody should be expected to like look at their little list and be like, all right, so we're doing the yellow tie and the blue stripe, you know, like it's too, you know, sometimes you just have to, like, it depends on the show. In some shows, it would be absolutely, everything would be laid out for you. And in some shows, it's like, well, you can handle that yourself. But we kind of made the decision that like, even though the designer had talked to the actors and been like, and now you put on these things, we were like, no, we're just going to streamline this. Don't worry about it.
So Kate had mentioned that you would be open to talking to us about how you are openly non-binary in your professional life and like just dig into that a little bit about
what
that means and everything. Is that cool?
Yeah, I would love to talk about that.
Okay, super. How did you navigate coming out at work? How did all that work? Like, how'd you make the move from telling colleagues about your changing pronouns and when did you change your bios and all that stuff?
Did you take it in steps or were you just like, you know what? Ready, set, here I am.
That's a really good question. I came out as non-binary toward the end of college. And it was challenging. Like, I think that there is more of an understanding of non-binary identities now than there was like 4 years ago, 5 years ago, when even coming out as binary trans was incredibly challenging. And so having to explain it and just like trying to get people to understand it is, you know, it's hard and it's very personal when it feels like people are kind of questioning your own, just questioning you. You know, it's hard to have kind of an unbiased conversation about like what they pronouns means or whatever when someone's kind of invalidating your identity. So I was very worried about coming out in my work, as even though I knew that like the theater industry is quite progressive, mm-hmm. even though like in some ways the theater industry sort of styles itself as progressive, and then like in terms of its policies, it's not. Mm-hmm. But in that very first wardrobe job that I was working, where if you recall, a friend of mine had gotten me the job, and so I knew that person, and so I had a conversation with him. His name is Hillel Friedman, and he is a wonderful like kind and sensitive and understanding producer who like really has everyone's best interests at heart. And so I talked to him about it. I was like, I really would like to come out. Like, do you think that would be okay? And before even I did that, there was a talk that I got to see. I don't remember what conference this was at, but I got to see a talk with a group of trans theater people. And there was a non-binary person on the panel. And I went up and asked them afterward, like, I'm thinking about coming out of my professional life. Do you think that that would like lose me jobs? Do you think that that's a thing that I could do? And they said, I think it will get you jobs. I think it is our time and like people want to hear our voices and you should come out and like you should make yourself visible. And so I was very worried too, but I was very encouraged by that conversation. And so I asked my friend Hillel about it and he was like, absolutely, we'll give you all the support that you need. We'll make sure that like people use your pronouns. And so I felt very supported. And so I basically, right when I started that job, I introduced myself with pronouns. I said, hey, my name is Jules. I had been using a different name before that. And so making the move was really helpful for getting people to refer to me as Jules. So I said, hi, my name is Jules. My pronouns are they, them. And I just did that every single time I introduced myself to someone. And from that point, I was like, I'm out. Like, I'm not going to, you know, I'm sort of like not going back. And I have definitely had like problems with it, but it was an incredibly affirming thing to come out at work and have people be like broadly okay with it. Because I was sort of imagining being like like thrown out, which like obviously, you know, wasn't going to happen, but it's just a scary and very personal thing.
Sure.
But I'm very, very glad that I did it, especially in some of the work that I do now. Like currently I'm designing the National Queer Theater Criminal Queerness Festival, and being on a team of queer artists, many of whom are trans, is, you know, so validating and life affirming in it. And it feels like I have something to contribute to that space because of my lived experience.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you felt safe and able to come out at work and that you felt as fully supported as your friend said that you were.
Me too. Because there are many, many people who don't. And my heart goes out to those people. Always hope that that is changing.
It also sounds to me like it was very just fortuitous that you were choosing to come out at work at a new workplace where like they didn't think of you as anyone but exactly who you were introducing yourself as.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems like it would be really helpful.
Mm-hmm. It is. Yeah. It is. But it just sucks that that's sort of a requirement, that it's so hard for people to change their minds.
Right. Because
people are like discovering themselves, but they're in a workplace that they've been in for a long time.
Yeah.
That's just makes it so much harder. You get a lot of resistance from people being like, well, you've always been this. Why are you this one?
Oh, boy.
Right.
Yep.
So queerness and theater are intricately connected to each other, I think. And
yeah,
I don't identify as a queer person, but there's a lot of stuff about theater being a loud and proud space. Did working in theater make it easier for you to come out, do you think? Did being in the industry have any impact on how comfortable you were doing it or how quick the process was?
Yeah.
A little bit before, and I'm curious about it if you're willing to go into it.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely would say that I had an easier time coming out working in theater because it's a creative space and a progressive space versus coming out like working for Goldman Sachs or something.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I will say, though, also, despite the fact that there is a thriving trans history and like current performers, I mean, like everybody from like people like Kate Bornstein, people like Travis Alabanza, people like Taylor Mack, like there are trans theater makers and artists who are like, you know, a huge part of the theater world and like making new work and all of that. That being said, theater, I think, is often traditionally regarded as a gay male space.
Mm.
And obviously I have had wonderful experiences working with gay men, but like cis gay men in theater can be somewhat insular. I sometimes feel as though I have trouble fitting myself into that world. Mm. So at the time that I came out, I was not working with any non-binary people. And at this point, now that I've done the Criminal Queerness Festival like two or three times, I have worked with quite a few non-binary people. But in most of the work that I do, I'm the only non-binary person and usually the only trans person. So that can be hard. And often the only sapphic person as well. So that can be a little bit tricky that, like, there is historically queerness in the theater world, but, like, most of the very visible queerness in the theater world is cis, gay, often white men.
Yeah.
So there are ups and downs, I would say.
Do you see much representation of non-binary people, like, as characters in shows that you've worked on? Is that something that's represented in the theater world and the shows that get put on now? Or is that changing at all?
It sort of depends on the level. In the Broadway that I've worked on, absolutely not.
Mm.
I've seen one Broadway show with a non-binary character. It was Head Over Heels,
which I
absolutely lost my mind over. There was a line. So Head Over Heels is a really lovely show. It is a mythological story, and the music is the music of the Bee Gees, I believe. And they sing Mad About You at the end of the show. There's a character who is non-binary and who like struggles with being fully seen as that. And at the end, they're reunited with their partner who like sees them fully and everything. And so they're all singing Mad About You. And he sings, I'm mad about them, mad about them. And I just started bawling in
the I got chills.
Yeah,
I got
chills.
I was like not okay, like ugly crying. Like an usher had to be like, "Are you okay?" Because I was like, the show was over, and I was just sitting there like crying because I was so happy to have seen that, because it's not something that I ever see on Broadway except for that instance. But that's something that I'm hoping will continue to change. But in some of the off-Broadway that I do, there is representation, specifically, again, the Criminal Queerness Festival, which is run by National Queer Theater, is very much committed to bringing those kinds of stories to light. And so I have done plays with them that are about non-binary people. There's a play that we did called Wafrica 123 that's based on the playwright's own experiences of being trans in Tanzania. And it was stunningly brilliant. So getting to work on stuff like that is makes me really hopeful and excited for the future. But at the moment, I would say for the most part, there is very little trans representation and
more work to do.
No non-binary representation. So yeah, a lot of work to do.
Yeah. What is your design process like? Like when you're designing costumes for a new show, where do you get inspiration from? Is the director telling you what you should do? I took a costume design course once just because it was the most interesting thing available to me from a set of choices, and it was awesome. In that, we just kind of read the play and started sketching things and then mocked them up in muslin. I was a high school student, so I was wondering, is that actually how it's done?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So it sort of depends on the show, but for the most part, my process is the same. It differs a little bit when it comes to like where the clothing is coming from, but usually I will read the play. I will have a meeting with the director about the play, and I will make sure to ask them, what is it? I got to take a class in college with John Doyle, who's a fabulous director, and it was really cool getting to hear about this process. And he recounted how one time somebody had asked him about a piece that he was working on, well, what are you trying to say? And that had like made him rethink his directorial process. And so I don't usually say that to directors because it's a little confrontational, but I will say, like, talk to me about this piece. What drew you to it? What are you really trying to pull out of this play? Like, what are we getting at? Because I want to be on the same page with the director, because I think I could look at a piece and I could design it many different ways. But I want to design it in a way that is speaking to the same message that the director was designing. And so then once I have that information, we'd like talk about the piece a little bit and like what it's about. Then I will do a bunch of research. I got to take a course in college with Anya Klepikov and Jane Cox, who are both fabulous designers, and Anya Klepikov said to me, like, you should never be afraid of doing too much research. And at the time I was like, ugh, that's dumb. I don't want to do all this research. Like, why do I have to do so much work? And now I totally resonate with that message. You can never really, as long as you're not overwhelming another person by showing them too much research, you can never do too much research. So I will research predominantly images of whatever it is that is relevant to the play. So like when I was doing falsettos, I was researching like New York Jewish families, and like, what do they look like? And how do they present themselves? And right now I'm doing a piece where one of the characters is Mexican and from the Toronto desert. And so I was like, what do people there dress like? Like, what are the imagery? Right. What's the imagery there like? And just keep looking at things and looking at things and looking at things and looking at things until I feel like I see things that speak to me and you know, express the same things as we're trying to express. If the director has mentioned things they want to include, specific images or specific, you know, if there's a problem that needs to be solved, like this person needs to look like a dog or whatever, like I will research that and be like, you know, addresses that, whatever the problem is that needs to be solved. So then I'll have my like world building research. You know, I might've come to a place where I'm like, I really think that this show lives in like a pastel place and there's a lot of like silks, and here are all of these images that I think really express that. And so then I'll have another meeting with the director for the world building, and then we'll start talking about individual characters,
right?
Because I like to establish a world first and then figure out how the characters fit into that world. And so then I will start to research the specific characters and figure out what I want for them. And then I'll have a meeting with the director being like, this is what I see for this character, this is what I see for this character, this is what I see for this character, with research. And then, depending on the show, usually I will do renderings in pencil or in pencil with watercolor or in pencil digitally to show exactly what I want. Sometimes if the show has a lot of characters or it's mostly modern clothes, I will do a collage instead of just like, here are the pieces that I think we should use. And like that gets across without doing renderings. But usually it's renderings. And then once we're all sort of agreed, I will work on getting my hands on the pieces, which depending on the show, that might just look like going up to 34th Street and buying a bunch of clothes. Right. It might look like ordering a bunch of things. It might look like planning and building a bunch of things. In which case I have to like get materials. I have to figure out what I'm making and make it. And then I will have fittings where we will try everything on and I will look at those with the director and see how they're thinking about everything and what needs to change. And then things might also change during the tech. And then the show goes up and that's the design. So everything's kind of in flux until opening.
I'm curious about how designing for or working on a talk show like John Oliver would be different from your theater experience, especially because I imagine that there's probably less research involved, but is that true? And also, is there something in particular that you enjoy about costume work for a talk show that you don't get to do or experience when you're doing a theatrical show or a film?
Yeah, totally. So yes, working on something like John Oliver is completely different because it's not a theater piece where like we need to costume everyone. It's a talk show where they decided they need one specific thing. And so they contract out someone to make that thing. In this case, I was working for the guy who built, if you've seen John Oliver, he really likes mascots. And yes. So there's this squirrel that is Mr. Nutterbutter, squirrel with a little fluffy tail. And so I was working for the person who built that squirrel. And we were building three more squirrels because for the big season finale of John Oliver a few years ago, they wanted a barbershop quartet of squirrels. So basically I just showed up and suddenly I was building mascots, which is something that I had never done before. And so I was just learning a completely different skill. The experience of like entering a shop and it just being like, all right, this is what we're doing, is completely different from designing because it is creative, but it's not like an introspective creative, like, what do we think we should do here? It's like, all right, I am in a shop and I didn't know what we were doing 15 minutes ago, but now I know that we are making squirrels. So I am going to squirrel pattern off of this EVA foam squirrel body what I need to do for these squirrels, and then I will cut that out of fur, which I've never done before, but that's what we're doing, and then I will stitch it to the squirrel, and then you're just off to the races, and that's what you're doing, which is another incredibly fun part of the job, is like learning a completely new skill on the fly. You know, I was suddenly learning like Muppet techniques from this guy who had worked on, you know, all of these different Muppet things and Saturday Night Live and a bunch of other stuff.
Let it be known, by the way, that I thought you said John Oliver likes ascots, as in like the clothing piece.
Smashing in an ascot, I think.
It's correct. I have since come around to the reality of what was happening. Somewhere around squirrel I clued in, but I just thought that would amuse you.
Yes, definitely does.
It's so interesting how like the way we were asking the question, it felt like you'd be like, well, you know, people are just wearing suits on the talk show or whatever. But no, that's where you did the most fantastical sort of thing that I've heard you talk about so far, is building a squirrel. In fact, the most fantastical thing you've done. What other stuff have you built in your career?
I've built a lot of pretty crazy things. I worked on the elephant puppet for Mean Girls.
What?
Which I believe was later cut. I don't know if they still have the giant animal puppets in Mean Girls or if they were cut. I built there's a designer that I really love to work with, Mia Drag the Baronic, who does like fantastical 3D printed things and like puppet work. He's just very, very smart in like working with unconventional materials. And I got to build with him some wings for the production of Carousel that was going on. And they were the most beautiful angel wings I've ever seen in my life, because they were made of foam that was cut with a water jet in these very specific undulating feather-like patterns. And then that was hit with a heat gun to make them curl. And then we airbrushed that with soft feather colors in like grays and browns and oranges, put in rooster feathers that matched the color of the wing. They were the most beautiful things I've ever seen in my whole life. And then they were cut from the production. Because that's one of the things about working on Broadway is that you will put all of this time and money and effort into something. Sometimes it's not the right all for the show and it just gets cut. So I know that those wings are just in a warehouse somewhere and I want them. But those were a good one. I've also, a thing that's fun when I'm designing smaller productions is that I can kind of set whatever I think I can handle making, I can put in the show. So I did a production a couple of years ago of A Midsummer Night's Dream where I built all of the costumes for the mortal lovers for the Midsummer Night's Dream out of trash, out of like plastic. So I had like a ruffled plastic coat covered in like big, it looked like a big fur coat, but it was made out of plastic and like rustled. I had another coat that looked like it was covered in feathers that I had covered in plastic gloves, things like that. And then for the fairies, I had things that were made out of natural elements. So I made these big tall crowns out of sticks. And I made this hat that looked like a giant rain cloud and had these long strings of beads hanging from it so that Puck could be a rainstorm. And I made this.
Oh my God.
And I made this short cape that was covered in gray feathers for Puck to be like the fog.
Ooh.
So that was a really fun one in terms of builds. It's actually the second show that I've done where I built a bunch of clothes out of trash. I really like building clothes out of trash. Another show with clothes built out of trash too. And I built a show almost entirely out of paper mache once. It was Pippin, and we needed like all of these helmets for Warriors of Science, and we needed like all of these animal masks for the like sex song. And so I was like, well, we want these to look like the players made them. So what if we just made them out of papier-mâché? And so all of a sudden I was learning how to do papier-mâché and I had this army of interns and we were just building, we had this like production line of all of these masks and weapons and puppets and armor and things that we were making out of
You should see the faces we're making at each other as you're talking about the masks. Oh my God.
Oh. Yeah, I built some crazy things.
So now that you've outlined for us the sort of back end of how costuming happens in different mediums for you, is there a particular myth about costuming that you would like to debunk for us or for our listeners?
Yes.
Please, by all means, set the record straight.
You cannot steam a garment while someone is wearing it.
Oh my God. That seems like very logical.
You cannot... I'm going to say it again. You cannot steam a garment while someone is wearing it. The number of times I've seen in a movie some like harried wardrobe person.
Oh, God.
Steaming a garment on a person. Steam is hot. I have gotten a steam burn is worse than a burn from boiling water. Steam is hotter than boiling water is. It's very dangerous. You have to be very careful when you steam things. You cannot steam something while someone is wearing it.
I didn't even notice that happening. Like you say that's how it's represented in film and stuff. I haven't seen that. You notice when you're in an industry.
Yeah,
I'm never going to be able to see that again because now every time it happens, I'm going to notice it and be like, God.
Cannot steam a garment while someone is wearing it.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah. You will hurt them. You will hurt yourself.
When you said that, I thought it meant that you had been in shows where people did that. And literally, I'm not saying this to be funny. It's actually true. The first thought in my brain was, where was the stage manager? How was somebody allowed to do that?
Oh, God, no. But I think people do it on themselves. I think I've heard of people, like, in their everyday lives, steaming, like a fancy garment that they're wearing to something on themselves because they don't know.
No.
Because literally, steam is hot.
You'll go to the hospital instead of your party. Don't do it.
Wow.
That's not where I thought that was going, but thank you.
Right? That's safety tips on making life podcasts.
That's a public announcement is what that is.
Yeah.
So when it comes to doing the work you do, it very much is work, right? That you get paid for. Are you in a union? And why or why not?
I am not yet in a union. I would like to be. I have only been doing this for 4 years. Yeah, like 4 years. A little less, like 3.5 years.
Relevant. How old are you? I don't actually remember this ever.
I'm 24.
Right, okay.
And you've done all these things. That's very impressive. Okay, keep talking about the union.
Yeah. Yeah, so I would like to be in a union, ideally the Austrian Designers, the Designers Union. And I honestly don't know as much about unions as I would like to. I have friends who are union professionals in other parts of theater, and every time I talk to them about unions, I just feel terrified and overwhelmed. And I wish that the information were more accessible than it is, because I just got offered a job on a Broadway show and did not get it because I wasn't union, which is yeah. So
is there a particular question you have about union membership that you'd like, I mean, obviously there are loads of them, but is there something particular in your brain? Because, hey, who knows who's going to hear this?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just wish that I knew more about how joining unions works. I wish that the information were a little bit more accessible. Yeah. I feel like every time I talk to someone about a union, it's like, all right, you're going to go down to 42nd Street and you're going to speak to Charlie. Charlie that the Rocks sing at midnight. And he'll let you into the AXE office. But don't talk to anyone and keep your head down. You're like, that's kind of the feeling.
Go to see Dimitri, but you didn't hear it from me.
Yes, exactly. That's kind of how it feels. I know that that's mostly an experience thing on my part. And I know that the unions are working very hard, especially right now, to protect people. But I would like to be involved in that. And I don't have as much information as I would like to. It's kind of surprising to me, honestly, how much work I've been able to do without being in a union. Like, it kind of feels like, is this allowed? Should I be allowed to be doing all of this?
Do you think you're being paid, like, comparably to what a union person would be paid?
Certainly not. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, it super depends on the job. It's always kind of astounding to me how much more money there is in Broadway work than, like, anywhere else. Just the difference between Broadway and, like, the next rundown. The amount of money that's, like, around is just completely different. But I think that union jobs pay much, much better. And honestly, one of the biggest parts of working in theater is learning how to advocate for yourself, which is something that I have, you know, struggled with in the past. Like when I first got to New York and I was like washing underwear in a sink after every single performance because I had been talked into doing that. Like I did not know how to advocate for myself. And it is a huge part of them surviving.
How is the relationship between costume designers and wardrobe people? Like, do you have a chance to talk to other people who do this, or do you end up kind of isolated because there's one per show? Like, I'm trying to think through how will you meet the right people who will tell you how you will get in a union? Like, do you get to talk to people much about this stuff?
It was tremendously isolating at the start because costume designers, and I have experienced this when I have my own wardrobe people, are incredibly busy and harried, and especially during tech, which is when the wardrobe person usually shows up. So you just have a quick conversation with the wardrobe, with the costume designer who's like, I need these things to happen at this time, and then you're just sort of expected to make it happen. And if you're being asked to do something unreasonable, it's very hard to speak out about it. I worked on a show once with just all of these button-up shirts. And the costume designer was like, you need to press all of these before every single show.
Oh, my God.
So I showed up like 3 hours before curtain. And I was just pressing shirts and pressing shirts and pressing shirts and pressing shirts. And then it was 5 minutes before curtain. And I was still pressing shirts and like crying. Because I was like 20 and I felt like I was doing a terrible job and, you know, ruining the whole show because I couldn't press all these shirts. And finally the stage manager, God bless her, like noticed what was going on. It was like, hey, can I talk to you outside for a second? And I was like, okay. And she like took me outside and was like, what's going on? And finally like got to have it, like made it so that I could have a conversation with the fashion designer and to tell her that I was being asked to do something unreasonable. But if I hadn't had that, you know, it's very hard to advocate for yourself. It's a thing you have to learn how to do.
I struggle with self-advocacy still. And like, I think that it's also a thing that all of us who are independent creative professionals, regardless of whether we're in theater or not, have to get really good at. And Heather, actually, in my experience of her, is, surprise, I'm going to talk about how great you are now, is really good at self-advocacy and is really good at teaching me how to better navigate that.
That's amazing. That is so admirable.
God, she's fabulous. Other than practice, is there something that has made the process of learning self-advocacy easier for you? Because, I mean, practice is the best thing for me in terms of getting used to, like, the language to use and how to present something so it doesn't come off as confrontational but still firm. But is there something other than practice that's worked for you?
Yeah, one of them is, just as you said with Heather, like, having people around and watching them advocate for themselves. I'm very lucky to have some friends who are older than me and work in theater and get to see how they advocate for themselves and talk to them about it. I'm just so grateful to have made some friends who work in similar positions to me, but who are, you know, 10 years down the line from me and me doing that same thing. That has made a huge difference, to just be like, is this okay? Am I asking for too much money? And have them be like, no, you're totally fine. Like, I had a job where, this was for Broadway, they wanted, they had a rack of dresses that was, what was this for? I don't remember what musical this was for, actually. But they had a rack of dresses that was a set piece, and they needed all the dresses to be shorter, because they were shortening the rack. And they were like, I need you to shorten these, you know, 100 dresses. Can you do that for, like, $300? And I was like, no.
Wow.
I don't know what they had said they wanted it for, but I said, like, that'll be, like, $1,200 or something. And the guy called me and tried to bully me into taking a lower price. He was like, this is, he didn't even say numbers. He was just like, this is ridiculous. You need to rethink this. And I was like, basically on the phone, I was just like, okay. And then I hung up the phone and I started crying. And then when I was done crying, I contacted a few different people and I was like, was I asking for too much money? And they were like, absolutely not. Yeah. You were asking for absolutely the right amount of money. He was bullying you. Having people who are also in the industry to talk to makes a huge difference.
So, yeah, I was thinking that the main way that I've learned to advocate for myself is watching other people doing it for themselves.
Yeah. So
sometimes, lucky for me, watching other people do it for me. Like, my mom was a fantastic advocate of me on many occasions. That was cool. But also more related to my work, a lot of what I learned came from seeing what other henna artists are up to and how they have, you know, advocated for themselves at various times and stuff. And the way I got to reach out to them and connect with them to actually, you know, have time to talk about that kind of thing. It never happens when you're actually working on the job. Like, right. I might meet another henna artist, like, on the job, and we're just sitting side by side, not really talking, doing our stuff. But it's that, like, downtime that's so important. And the place I end up getting to connect with other people who do what I do is two main things. The first one that I got to experience really early on is online forums that are specific to your industry are so helpful. And then the other thing is industry specific conferences. That's where you're going to meet the people who have been doing this forever. And usually the ones who are hanging out in those spaces are, like, they want to share with the next generation or whatever and make things easier, and they tend to be, like, really giving and nice, and they're just very happy, welcoming sorts of places. Does that exist for theater, either of you guys?
Well, I mean, it reminds me of, Jules, what you were saying about the conference you went to where the trans theater maker was like, yes, you should come out at work. Yes, that will actually help your professional world.
Mm-hmm. What kind of conference was that one?
I don't remember. Genuinely don't remember what the conference was. I'm so sorry. It might have been. I don't think it was an industry-specific conference. It literally might have been, like, Broadway Con.
It's pretty industry-specific. But, yeah, if there were some kind of get together of costumers. That would be so cool.
You would.
The place that I see a lot of this actually is Facebook groups.
That is the way now. Yeah.
There are Facebook groups for costumers. There are Facebook groups for queer people in theater. There are Facebook groups for. I mean, I get a lot of work through Facebook groups, which I hate. I hate getting work over text. I hate getting work over Facebook. I hate getting work over Instagram. Like, just email me. I hate it. But I also have conversations with people, and people will, like, you know, post in the groups and just be like, this thing happened, what do you think I should do? And people really support each other, which is really wonderful.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, that's good.
To get back to working not on theater, or partially not on theater, is there something that you prefer about working on, like, talk shows or, I suppose, or TV of other sorts?
That
you don't get to do in theater stuff.
Yeah, so the thing I do love about working on TV is that, like, the experiences that I've had with it are always like, we need this crazy thing, bring in all of your people, and we're gonna make, you know, armor for Gal Gadot for Saturday Night Live, you know, like, come on in, we have Wardlow to move, you know, that I really enjoy the kind of, this obviously isn't true for all TV, but, like, you know, no expenses barred, like, this thing needs to happen, and we're gonna make happen right now.
Right. I absolutely missed that was, like, a common experience of yours. I thought that was just, like, this one time I worked for John Oliver and my working for John Oliver was this shape. I didn't understand that was regularly the shape of, like, your work on TV.
That's
so
cool.
Yeah, that happens a lot with TV, is, like, we just need this thing, call your guy, we have 2 days, you know, get the thing done, and then that guy will call all of the people who have ever worked for him and be like, please come in and work on this thing. And we just make it happen. That's really, really fun. And also the money is better, which I'm sure is what everybody says.
Is that, like, that sounds like a really good place for the Facebook group to come in. Just, like, put out the beacon, like, hey, who's free?
That's how I got the John Oliver job. They were like, it wasn't even in a costumer Facebook group. It was a props Facebook group. Somebody was like, we need somebody to come in and sew for this. And they didn't even say what it was. And I was like, all right, I'll come sew for this. And then it was squirrel costumes for John Oliver.
Nice.
What's a piece of advice that you would give to somebody who's starting out that you didn't hear when you were training or learning about costume work, whether that's for specifically non-binary people or more general?
That's a really good question. Let me think about that for a second.
Yeah.
The piece of advice that I have for people, just generally people starting out in the industry, clothes are heavier than you think they are.
Mm.
Don't get conned into carrying huge piles of clothing around if there's another person who could help you, because clothes are heavier than you think they are. And also, like, going off of that, don't think that you have to make everything happen yourself in order to be a good employee or a good costumer or a good designer. Like, you can delegate, you can ask for the things that you need. Like, I was just in a production meeting where we were talking about laundry for this festival, and there was sort of a silence where, like, I could have popped up and said, I will come in and do the laundry, but that's not my job, so I didn't.
That's, like, such an interesting, sorry, I just got really excited because that's such an interesting tie-in to self-advocacy, too. Sometimes the way to self-advocate is to not volunteer to do the thing people are clearly hoping you'll volunteer to do.
Yes.
Yes.
People need you more than you think they do. You don't have to be a team player always, rather than, and otherwise you'll get, like, fired, but that's not.
It's possible, too, to be a team player and still have boundaries at work.
Yes. And being a team player is a ridiculous concept that's just, like, a way of getting people to do things that they're not going to get to do.
Yes.
And this is the other thing. People respect professionals who do advocate for themselves and don't volunteer for everything. I think there's a phase in everyone's professional life in a creative world where you're just, like, so happy to be here, and, like, this is amazing, and I'm bright-eyed and shiny, and I will do anything you call me to do.
Right.
Uh-huh. Including washing the underwear every night.
Washing the underwear every night in a sink, because I'm just so happy to be here, and you can make me do anything.
Right.
And that is a phase of professional life that you want to get out of as soon as you can. Like, as soon as you have connections. I mean, I don't even think you need to be that person ever.
Right.
But I definitely was. You don't have to be that person to get work. And in fact, if you are that person, people will respect you less and they will make you do more.
Even though they'll talk about how great you are for being super willing.
Yes. They'll be like, thank you so much. We couldn't have done this without you.
Which is great, and they should say that. They should absolutely be really vocal about how grateful they are. But also, it's okay to stop doing that and ask for money. It's okay to be like, I will not do this.
The being so grateful thing just sparked this thought of a experience I had like 3 days ago where I had booked this gig that it was a well-paying gig, and they made it clear, fortunately, that it would be a well-paying gig. And when I was there being paid, everyone who was there assumed that I was volunteering.
Oh,
and they, so it felt super different than other gigs that I've done.
Yeah.
And like, there was so much, thank you so much for doing this, but also not respecting my boundaries or needs. Like, my contract just says I need light because I can't draw in the dark. And like, the person who signed that contract knew that, and they knew all the other things that I like said I needed, but everyone who was there working the event, directly interacting with me, had not heard that stuff apparently, and like didn't seem to think it was reasonable to go find me a light, please, because there's not one here.
What did you do?
I used my cell phone as a flashlight for the last like half hour. It was an event that went like 5 to 9. They're like, oh, the sun goes down really late now. I'm like, no, by 8, it's going to be too dark to see well. Please, I need this. But it comes back to just, if people have the impression, like, I'm just so happy to be here. Like, I'm just here because I love doing this thing so much.
Yeah.
They treat you very differently than when you're the well-paid, hired person who they had to like
negotiate with
and like make sure that you were even available. Not being available sometimes is very good for you.
I have complicated feelings about this, and actually I'm a little scared to voice them because I think still towards the beginning of my career, and I am a very,
I don't know if anybody can tell this, ha 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 ha, you both know me,
but I'm like, I'm a really effusive person, and if I say to you, I'm really glad I'm here because I love doing this work, I'm really excited to do this gig, I'm really excited to do this show, I'm not saying that because it sounds good, I'm not saying that because I'm supposed to say that. And if I say to somebody, I'm really grateful that you're doing this work, I mean that.
Yeah.
It's really important to me to be genuine in those ways. And I am deeply, deeply grateful to get to do this for work. Like, that's totally true. And I don't enjoy the fact that being openly grateful to volunteers seems to be conditional in a way. Because you're right that the gratitude does get toned down once you're getting paid, which is really weird. I don't know. Like,
there is that too. The gratitude gets toned down.
The gratitude from other people, I should say. Like,
from yourself, obviously.
Gratitude for being in the space is fine, but like the gratitude from other people about, oh, thank you so much for putting in all this effort and time. I still put in effort and time. You just paid me this time.
They don't have to thank you. They thanked you in dollars.
Right.
I have two thoughts about this. The first is that, like, I absolutely didn't mean to imply that any gratitude is not genuine, excitement on the part of like people who have written in Bushy Tail is not genuine. Like, it is genuine.
Right.
And then the second thing is that what sucks is that genuine excitement and gratitude can mean that people will take advantage of you. And that is so hard for me because, especially in the theater industry in New York, the kind of default is to be really jaded. That's kind of like
one thing. Yeah. Like, and then if you're really like openly excited, then you're like, oh, look at the sweet new girl. Let's see how long it takes before she's jaded like the rest of us.
Exactly. And I don't like to be jaded. I love my job. I love being part of the theater industry. But I also do need to talk to people on jobs that I'm doing in particular ways that don't make me seem like I am
a kid,
someone to take advantage of. Like a kid, like a, you know, I had an industry friend tell me, when you're starting up in the industry, you are 25 until you're 25. Like, if people ask you how old you are, you say you're 25, which is totally reasonable. Mm. But I have all of this enthusiasm for theater. Sometimes I do not bring that with me to work because I don't want to be...
Because you want to be taken seriously?
Yeah, because I want to be taken seriously, and I want it to be known that, like, I'm not someone to mess with.
Oh boy, do I feel that. Yeah. Oh boy.
But it doesn't mean that I don't feel it.
Oh, absolutely. You know?
Every time I get to go to the garment district and pick out a bunch of beautiful, shiny things for a project and, like, rifle through all of the trims and fabrics and go into all these places that are piled high with, you know, satins and silks. I love that. I deeply, deeply love it. And I deserve to be paid reasonably to do the things I love. So both of those things, I think
that this is part of the learning that I am doing, is finding the line between, yeah, I am really excited to be here and I am really bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and, like, effusive, but also I also do that where, like, sometimes I won't bring that to a gig because I want to walk in and be treated like a professional. And unfortunately, the way that our society is right now, you often have to choose between the two. Mm-hmm. Particularly as a female presenting person, I think.
Yeah.
That's totally true.
Yes, absolutely. There's a huge gender divide in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And getting people to use my correct pronouns is part of getting them to respect me.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also something that I feel very strongly about.
As you guys were talking, I was just thinking, it makes me sad that you feel like you have to not seem enthusiastic when you show up to gigs or people won't respect you or whatever.
It is sad. It sucks.
It's so sad. And I'm like, why is this? How do we fix this?
I don't know. I often do it anyway. I'm often like, hey, guess what? I get to do this thing. That's really great. But then if the person who booked me walks in the room, it becomes, hi, I'm so glad to see you.
Okay.
Thank you. You know, like, it's a little bit of a different, it's a different shade of joy.
Yeah.
You know? Because if I'm, like, jumping up and down,
right,
they're not going to treat me like an adult. They're just not.
Yeah.
I have a slightly sad, jaded, capitalism is evil thought about this.
Go for it.
Which is that it sometimes feels like if you are doing something that you enjoy, you will never be paid enough for it because they know that you enjoy it, and so they won't pay you. That goes for working in creative fields, that goes for working in nonprofits. And so the only way to get paid a reasonable amount is to do something that nobody wants to do. And then they will pay you enough. Because if they know that you like it, then they know that they can afford to, like, not pay. And, like,
That makes me think about, like, I wonder if performative jadedness is a thing.
Probably.
It is for me.
I feel that.
Yeah.
I still walk into Times Square and I go, this is the least New Yorker thing. Like, I will never be a real New Yorker because this is true about me. I still walk into Times Square and I go, wow, look at all the people. Look at all the like, look at all the shows. This is so cool. And then, like, I leave because Times Square is, you know, smelly and crowded. But, like, I still have that feeling. And I actually have one really close friend who also works in the theater industry who's also trans. And so we have very sort of parallel careers. And he and I both feel that way about Times Square. And so that's sort of our little, like, benchmark of, like, I don't want to get so jaded about New York theater that I am no longer excited about.
Yeah.
I also just want to point out, I don't live in the city and I have never lived in the city. I am a native New Yorker and I will be proud of that until I die. And I, in fact, was not vocal about it until I moved out of state to go to college and realized how proud I was to be from New York. But in a similar vein to the fact that Heather and I often talk about how you are legitimate, regardless of where you are on your professional or creative non-professional path, you are a New Yorker, and that is real. You are a real New Yorker, Jules, no matter how starry-eyed you get about Times Square at night or at Christmas or on a random Wednesday. You just are.
That's very kind of you. I don't know that I fully agree with you, but I appreciate the sentiment.
I hear that you're not there yet, but I want to offer it to you that I consider you a real New Yorker.
I really appreciate that. I've gotten a lot of weird benchmarks from people about what you have to do to be a real New Yorker. I had a boss tell me once that you're not a real New Yorker unless you've lived there for 10 years and then left and then come back. And then you're
that's
a real
a lot.
New Yorker.
That's a high bar.
To come back. I know, right? Like,
That excludes anyone under 30.
Yeah.
Like,
that's yeah. Crap. The whole thing is just very, I have a lot of feelings about people because people don't seem to have this about other places, except maybe LA, but like,
I don't know. I'm not a real Rhode Islander still.
Well, that's what
I have owned my house in Rhode Island for 13 years or something. People have feelings about
people
what makes you
really,
real and,
right.
and connected
get really
to the place.
Intense and like possessive about this. But yeah, I think it's gatekeeping and I think it's exclusive and I think it's stupid and I think you're a real New Yorker and people
Thank
can
you.
Fight me about that if they want. I know how to broadsword with my crutches. We are almost done, but we have a couple more questions for you.
Okay.
Can you tell us about a system you've created or a tool you've found to make your work or life easier?
There's a lot of paperwork involved in costume design that I find really helpful. And I was lucky enough to see that modeled for me by people that I worked for. So I got a sense of it myself. A piece list is an essential part of costuming and having an understanding of who's wearing what in what situations, and then also having like a purchase list of what you're looking for.
What are they? Can you explain them for non-costumers?
Yes. So a piece list is just every piece that's in the show, usually by character and also by scene. It's just every piece that you need for the show to happen. And it's also sometimes this different paperwork, sometimes it's the same piece of paperwork. It's also which pieces are worn at which times so that you understand, you know, just what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of your roadmap of costume for the show. And then you also have a measurement. You can make a measurement chart with people's sizes and things.
Mm.
And for the longest time, I would have like my piece list in one hand and my measurement chart in the other hand. And I would be going around looking for pieces. And I'd be like, all right, this person needs a white t-shirt. What size t-shirt should they wear? They wear a medium. Okay, a medium t-shirt. And a few years ago, I realized that I could just go through and put the size that each of the pieces needs to be right into the piece list instead of having those be two different pieces of paperwork.
Yeah.
I don't know why that was a completely nuts epiphany for me, but it was. I was like, oh my God, I've done it.
Yeah.
So much easier now.
If it makes you feel any better, I absolutely wouldn't have figured that out for a couple years either.
Right.
Because, like, if you get trained a certain way, right, or if you get told there's this paperwork and there's this paperwork, your brain just kind of gets used to there being two pieces of paperwork. And then the idea of that changing when it's what you've always been taught is like, oh, wait, what if we did this thing?
Yeah, totally. Another thing that is really helpful for me is having a receipt pouch. Whenever you're shopping anything, you should always have a very specific place that your receipts go, and you should know, like, kind of how you organize them. I like to fold my receipts into little sandwiches with a store name right on the top, so that if I'm doing returns, it's very easy to flip my receipts and find, you know, the H&M receipt that I need to return this thing.
You should know that while you were saying this, Heather proceeded to pick up her purse and show me her receipt pouch.
Yeah, come on, receipt pouch. Yes.
It's important. How are you going to keep track of all that?
Yeah, you got to keep track of your receipts.
If you put it somewhere else, you may well forget to account for it.
But it's not just for taxes. It's also for reimbursement. That's a whole, just in case that's not clear to anybody who's listening. Like, you should always have your receipts for taxes, but also if you're lucky and you're working on a show, or if you're at a certain level and you're working on a show, they're going to reimburse you for, you know, props you buy or pieces you buy or whatever that the shops don't already have. So
I would hope they're always doing that. Are they not?
Reimbursing
you?
You should never spend your own money on anything.
Yeah.
Ever.
I think I was leaving that out for community stuff because community theaters never reimburse you ever.
Oh,
but if you're
so you
working,
should never buy anything.
No, but if you're working professionally, then you should be compensated for doing that for sure.
Yeah, you should know before you spend any money what you are expecting in terms of reimbursement.
Right. Yes.
You should have had a conversation with the producer, with the finance people, or whoever it is that you're working with about what the expectation is for reimbursement, if there is an expectation for reimbursement, just before you spend any money, you should.
Yeah.
But that's not a tool. That's just.
Right. It's a different sort of tool, though, because like, I think it's important to know, too, that when you get a gig, whether it's a singing gig or a theater gig or whatever, having the conversation about money is something everybody is expecting. Everybody who ever work for knows that conversation is coming and has had it with other people a whole bunch of times. You are not overstepping by making sure you get compensated.
You know who else needs to hear this? Teachers. All of the teachers, because like they fall into a similar category of like, I just love what I'm doing so much, and like my heart is here. And they, I know many teachers who buy things and are not reimbursed, and like they don't even expect it. And, like, because it's so rare that anyone actually does. That's one thing that COVID sort of gave to a lot of teachers, I think, I hope. Like, when they had to go virtual, the school somehow finally realized that they would have to buy things and then, like, supplied equipment like microphones or video cards or webcams or whatever. I don't know. Like, if... Yeah, whoever you are working with and for needs to know what things you need to work well, and they need to pay for them.
Thank you, though, for those tools. Those are really helpful, and I am actually already thinking about how I can apply them to the work that I do also.
Yeah.
Yay.
I had a friend who works in props make my other friend who works in props a beautiful receipt patch as a birthday gift.
Oh.
It's very pretty. It had the New York Times crossword all over it.
I love that.
My physical, my receipt pouch is always a certain pocket on my purse for me. I don't have a separate one. I think I might lose it if I did.
Yeah, actually, I use the zip up area of my wallet for receipts. And I always have them on me.
So I think we are at the time for our final question that we love the most. Can you tell us one of your favorite things about doing costuming for a living?
Oh gosh, there's so many. Yes, I think my favorite thing about doing costumes for a living is how unglamorous it is. And I will explain that. I will explain that. I think that a lot of people think of theater as being very glamorous and very fancy. And, you know, the bright lights and the beautiful costumes and the dancing. And it is, when you see a show, that's absolutely the experience. It's magical. That's the whole point of it, right?
Yeah.
When you are working on a show, it is so unmagical. And that is my favorite thing. The dressing rooms are like weird and grubby, like not dirty, but like every backstage area in a professional New York theater is like super weird looking. And there's like random areas and low ceilings and like ramps you have to walk down, like weird light bulbs and stuff. Super strange looking. All of the costume shops are messy. All of the, you know, stocks that you go through are like strange and dusty, and like all of the magic is actually just work that people put in to make, you know, Cinderella's transforming dress in the Broadway Cinderella. I actually know how that works, and I'm not allowed to tell people, but like it's not magic that made that dress transform, even though it felt like magic. It was the ingenuity and hard work and skill of a group of people. And I'm part of that group of people. And so every time I see something happen in a show that I designed or I worked on, feeling that magic and knowing exactly where it came from, that is probably my favorite thing.
That's gorgeous.
That's cool.
Gorgeous. It also just brings home for me in a different way. Art is people, theater is humans, and music is humans. And that like,
We put
professionals and role models on such a pedestal, and they're just as human as the rest of us. They make just as much mess in the costume shop as we would.
Right. They've just had maybe more time to have gotten more work done, so they seem more magic.
Right. Yes. And so like the magic of
the arts is people who want to be there putting their work into making a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, even the like most the things that feel grandest and most automated. Like, I know that Phantom of the Opera feels like this incredibly automated, like everything is just run by computers kind of show. And I actually, my friend took me backstage at Phantom, and like the boat is an RC car.
What?
Like, really? There are people handling everything in that show. Yeah, like, there's right. a lot of really fancy equipment involved, but like, it's all people, all of it. Even the most, you know, grandest things.
God, I love this question so much. Thank you. Yeah. That was a super gorgeous answer. Yay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And a great way to close out the episode.
Yes, thank you again for coming and geeking out with us about doing this. Yay.
Yeah, it was super fun. I hope that it was helpful for people.
It was awesome. We actually have one more question, which is, how can people find out about what you're up to creatively now or what you have coming up?
My website is juliapiperl.com. JuliaPiperl.com. You know, not having your domain name match your actual name, hashtag just trans things. But the best place to find out about what I'm currently doing is my Instagram. So my Instagram is Jules Piperl, JuliaPiperl. And I post work that I'm working on and things that I have coming up and all of that good stuff.
Yesterday there was, this will be much later by the time this goes live, but yesterday there was a picture of some Hobbit costumes.
Nice. That,
oh my God, you guys, the things that this human makes.
It makes some very fun things.
Yay.
Right now I'm making a drag striptease costume of Pope Alexander VI.
Oh my God.
So go check out my Instagram for that because I'm really excited about it.
Hooray.
Making Life Podcast is produced by your hosts, Heather Kant Knowlton and Kate Clifford, with music from November Party. Find us at www.makinglifepodcast.com.